Good morning, everybody. So glad that you are here with us or watching online. If you got a Bible or you have it on your device, let's grab it and go to Matthew chapter 18, the Gospel of Matthew chapter 18. I want to ask you, and I want to see a show of hands as we start this morning. Has anybody in the room ever been offended? Let me see your hands. Yeah. You ever had that experience where somebody just did something or said something that just kind of got under your skin? Or maybe that that time where you really just had one nerve left and that certain someone was just dancing all over it, right? Some of you are looking side-eye at somebody down the row from you right now. Or some of you may actually have to sit across the table from that person at Thanksgiving on Thursday, right? They'll say, can you pass the gravy? And you just want to pass it all over the top of their head, right? Because none of us escapes being offended. This is part of life. We experience those interpersonal offenses inescapably. But let me ask it a little more pointedly and a little more poignantly. You don't have to raise your hand this time. But has anybody in the room ever been hurt? Have you ever been wounded? Have you ever been belittled, demeaned, gossiped about, betrayed by someone you thought you could trust, hurt by somebody you thought cared about you? Have you ever experienced those kinds of deep, painful, relational wounds? The reality is none of us escape being offended, but none of us escape being hurt. The thing is that for those of us who are followers of Jesus, we have a call on our lives to respond to the reality of those relational wounds in a way that is distinctive, a way that's different from the way of the world, a way that some may look at and see as completely irrational. It doesn't make any sense. A way that is questionable. We're in the sixth and final week of this sermon series that we've called Questionable. It's about the idea that we are called as followers of Jesus to live distinctive lives that don't make sense to the world around us. Lives that cause them to wonder about us. Who are these people? Why do they live this way? And who is this God they claim to follow? We've taken as our sort of jumping off point for the series the words of the Apostle Peter in 1 Peter chapter 3, where he says, live such good lives among the pagans that though they may accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. And then later he says, and always be prepared to give an answer for anyone who asks for the reason for the hope that you have within you. We're to live such good lives, such distinctive lives, that it causes people to ask questions. We've, through the course of this series, talked about the idea of a questionable work ethic. The way in which we see and engage our work and the people that we work with is supposed to be question posing. We talked about questionable money habits, the way we spend our money, the way that we give our money, the world around us finds questionable. We've talked about questionable politics and questionable morality, questionable sexual morality, and the way in which we're supposed to live distinctively in those ways, to live out our lives differently from the world around us. After last week's sermon on sexuality, a buddy of mine came up to me and was like, are you trying to talk about all the hard stuff before Thanksgiving? And I said, wait till you hear what we're talking about next week. Now, the subject today is actually a lot easier to talk about than politics or sex. But it's actually really hard to live out this calling. Because this week we're talking about the call of God on our lives as followers of Jesus to live out questionable forgiveness. You see, every time we're wounded, every time we're hurt, there's a debt that is incurred. That person who has hurt us owes us something, and there is a debt, and we have the desire and the right to make them pay. And yet, as followers of Jesus, we're called to deal with those hurts, to deal with those debts in a way that is different, in a way that's distinctive. And Jesus speaks about this in Matthew chapter 18. The context of Matthew 18, Jesus is actually talking about how you deal with hurt that happens in the context of the church. He talks about when your brother or sister sins or sins against you, what you're supposed to do with it. And the first thing he says is you go to them personally, individually, one-on-one, and you try to work it out. You try to deal with it. And he says if that person is unwilling to acknowledge the reality of their sin, then you invite a couple other people, trusted people, into the process with you. If they're still unwilling to recognize the reality of their sin, repent of it, then you get the church involved. Jesus talks there about how to deal with these offenses and these hurts that inevitably come up in the life of the church. And then Peter asks a question. And I just love it when Peter asks questions, don't you? Because you know you're in for a treat after this, right? Peter tries so hard, and yet time and time again, Peter just gets it wrong, right? Adventures in missing the point. I think that's why I love Peter so much, because I can identify with that. And so Peter hears this little teaching from Jesus about how you deal with hurt in the life of the church. And then Peter comes to him, and we pick up the story in Matthew chapter 18, verse 21. Then Peter came to Jesus and asked, "Lord, how many times shall I forgive my brother or sister who sins against me? Up to seven times?" And Jesus answered, "I tell you, not seven times, but 77 times." Now, Peter, after hearing this little teaching from Jesus, does what I think religious people are just so prone to do, and that is he asks for a formula. Peter wants a formula. "Jesus, give me a formula. This whole forgiveness thing, give me a formula. How many times should I do it?" And aren't we so prone to want a formula? And yet life with Jesus, it's not about a formula. It's about a way of life. And Jesus' response to Peter makes that clear. But Peter wants a formula. And it's really interesting because I think Peter's actually trying to score some brownie points with Jesus at this point, right? He's trying to impress Jesus. You see, there was a common formula in Jesus' day, a common formula that was taught by the rabbis of Jesus' day. And that is that you were obligated to forgive your brother or sister three times. Three times you're obligated, you have to forgive them. And after that, then all bets are off. And Peter is thinking he's really gonna impress Jesus because he's gonna up the ante, right? He's gonna take the formula of the day, double it, and then add one more for good measure to get the biblical number of completion, the number seven. "Jesus, how many times do I have to forgive my brother or sister? Seven times?" Thinking Jesus is gonna be impressed, but he's not. Jesus replies and says, "I tell you, not seven times, 77 times," or as some of your translation will say, 70 times seven. Now, I studied theology so as to avoid math as best I could, but I'm told by reliable experts that 70 times seven is 490. Did I get that right? Yeah, 490 times. Jesus says 490 times you're supposed to forgive that person. That's hard to keep track of, right? I've decided that I could actually make a killing off of the sometimes rather gullible Christian community by developing an app, a 70 times seven app, right? Just a simple app on your phone. You can download it from the Google Play Store, right? And just an app where you can just keep track, right? 488. 489, you better watch out, because once we hit 490, I am going off on you, right? Is that the point that Jesus is trying to make? Of course not. They were supposed to keep track until we get to that threshold of 490. Now, what's the deal, though? There's something odd about this. The NIV actually has 77 times. Some of your translations, or even in the footnote in the NIV, it says 490 times, 70 times seven. Why the difference between those two numbers? Like, I mean, that's a pretty big gap between 77 and 490. Like, I'm not even gonna try to do that math. Why the discrepancy? Well, you have to actually understand a little bit about what Jesus is alluding to. You see, because I think here what's going on in this passage is Jesus is actually making an allusion, like he often is wont to do, back to the Old Testament. Jesus' whole mind and way of thinking is deeply shaped by his tradition, by the Old Testament. And I think Jesus here is alluding back to a story that we read in Genesis chapter 4, all the way back at the beginning of the Bible. In Genesis chapter 4, the whole chapter begins with the story of Cain and Abel. It's the first murder that's told about in the Bible, where Cain kills his brother Abel. And as you keep reading then down through the remainder of that chapter, you see a genealogy that comes next, and then you come to the story of a man named Lamech. And Lamech was a bad dude, right? Lamech is the first person in the Bible to be a polygamist. So we see that he's even there exploiting these women in his life. And we see that Lamech is a man whose life is filled with violence. He says, I've killed a man for injuring me. And he comes to the end of that little statement where he talks about killing somebody just for injuring him. And he says an interesting statement to his wives. He says, Cain is avenged 7 times. Lamech is avenged 77 times. It's kind of his way of saying, you think Cain was a bad guy? You ain't seen nothing yet. It's Lamech's way of saying, you break my arm, I break your neck. He's always wanting to up the ante, to get back at. Because you see, when somebody hurts me, when somebody wrongs me, there's a debt incurred. And Lamech says, I have the desire and the right to make them pay. Anybody remember the old movie, The Untouchables? Right, Kevin Costner, Sean Connery. It's an old movie now, but it's a good one. It's the story of Elliot Ness, who's a cop who's chasing after the gangster Al Capone. And Costner, who plays Ness, goes and recruits Sean Connery, this sort of old curmudgeon-y cop, to join his elite squad, this group, the Untouchables, to go after Capone. And there's sort of a sense in which Connery just sort of wants to live a quiet life and be done with all that. But at one point, he gets passionate. And he says, you want to know how to get Capone? He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He puts one of yours in the hospital, you put one of his in the morgue. That's the Chicago way. I think the Chicago way lives inside all of us, right? The Lamech way lives inside all of us. You've hurt me, you've wounded me, you've incurred a debt, and I have the desire and the right to make you pay. And I think the point that Jesus is making here is that just as Lamech's desire for vengeance always outmatched the offense against him, so too we who are followers of Jesus, that our willingness to forgive should always outmatch the offense against us. You see, and this is gets a little nerdy at this point, but what you have actually is in this passage from Genesis 4, in the ancient Hebrew manuscripts, the number in Genesis 4 is 77, but the ancient Greek translations that would have been the common Bible read by many in the first century world actually has 70 times 7. And so this is what leads a little bit to this conundrum of scholars trying to figure out, should we translate this 77 or 70 times 7? The number isn't the point. The point is, our willingness to forgive ought to always outmatch the offense against us. The point isn't the number. The point is to lose track of the number, to stop keeping score. And then Jesus goes on to tell a story about why that's the case, why it is that we're supposed to be those who deal differently with the debt incurred against us when somebody hurts us. And he tells this story. It's a familiar story. You've probably heard it before if you've been around church much at all, if you've been around IBC much at all. It's the story of the unmerciful servant, it's sometimes called. It's a story that Jesus tells about this king, and this king he's lent a lot of money to a lot of people, and he comes to a point where he's wanting to collect on the debts. And so he calls before him one servant in particular who has this massive debt. This servant has incurred a debt from the king of 10,000 talents. And your jaws are supposed to drop at that point, except they don't, because we don't know what a talent is. Some of your translations will say 10,000 bags of gold. A talent by itself, one talent, was actually a sizable sum of money. For the average daily peasant worker, a talent was how much you would make over the course of 20 years. So for him to repay this debt would take him 200,000 years of work. How's that for some mathematics? There's a lot of math in this sermon today. But you get the idea. I mean, this would be like putting the entire national debt on the back of one person. It's an unimaginable sum of money for a person in that context. And Jesus uses that extreme in order to make the point of the story. This man has laid on his back this incredible debt that is completely beyond his capacity to repay. And he's summoned before the king and he says, I can't pay. And the king orders that he and his wife and children be sold into slavery, all their property sold so that he can get back something from the debt that he is owed. And what you see is that this servant then pleads for mercy. He says, King, just would you be patient with me? I'll pay it back in full. And there's like a whole sermon just about that response, about the foolishness that we could ever feel as though we could repay the debt we owe to God. It's foolish. But he pleads with the king, please be patient with me. I'll pay it back in full. And then Jesus says, the king took pity on him. He canceled the debt and he released him. And I think here in this little story, this little narrative, we actually have a beautiful little nutshell summary of the nature of the gospel. That the king, the great king, God himself, takes pity on us, cancels the debt against us, and lets us go free. But then what happens, the story continues, and this servant goes on, and he now, having been set free from his enormous, unimaginable debt, he goes and he finds somebody who owes him some money. And this man, we're told, owes him 100 denarii. This is not a small sum of money exactly. It's the equivalent of about 3 months' worth of labor, 3 months' worth of income for an average day laborer. No small sum of money, and yet it's a tiny drop in the bucket compared to what he owed the king. And the response of the one that he goes to demanding that he repay the debt is the same response that he gave the king. Be patient with me, and I'll repay it in full. And yet he refuses. And he demands that this man be thrown into prison until he can repay the debt, which doesn't actually seem like a particularly good strategy for getting the debt paid back, right? Well, the king catches wind of this. Some people who knew the whole story about what had happened go back to the king and said, you're not going to believe this. And they tell him what happened. And the king summons the servant back in front of him. And he looks at the man and he says to him, are you kidding me? Right? That's the Greek. No, not really. He's like, you wicked servant, how dare you? I forgave you this enormous sum and then you refuse to forgive as I have forgiven you. And then we read at the very end of that the king orders that him to be taken away and punished. And we hear the end of that story and go, yeah, that's justice. This guy got what he deserved. And then we come to the next verse. And frankly, this is one of those verses that I really wish wasn't in the Bible. Right? I mean, there are just some of those verses that it would be a lot more convenient if they weren't in the Bible. These are strong words from Jesus. Look what he says, verse 35. This is how my heavenly Father will treat each of you unless you forgive your brother or your sister from your heart. Those are strong words from Jesus. We've gone from going, yeah, get him, he got what he deserved, to going, oh no, that's me. These are strong words from Jesus and yet speaks to a perpetual tendency of the fallen human heart. And that is that we really love mercy for us and justice for them. It's kind of like, have you had that experience? We've all had this experience where you're driving down an unfamiliar road and you're in the left-hand lane and you're coming up to a stoplight and you get close to the light. Only when you get close to the light do you see the little sign and discover that you're in a left turn only lane, right? And there's a long line of cars that are waiting at the light to go straight. And you got to figure out some way to get into that line. You had this experience, and so you sort of nudge the front end of your car just a little bit in that direction. You put your blinker on, right? You start looking over at them with a really pleasant look on your face. You smile, give a little wave, And they're like looking the other way. You're going, there is no way that you don't see me right now. But you finally catch their eyes and you wave, and they wait and they let you get in, right? Then the next time you're on that road, it's now not so unfamiliar anymore, and you're going straight and you're in line, and that person is trying to, they're doing the wave to you, and you're like, uh-uh, you scoot a little closer to the car in front of you. Serves you right, sucker. You should have known better, right? Because we love mercy for us and justice for them. Now, don't get me wrong here. There are times when the way that a person has injured us, they need justice. They need the consequences of their sin. Particularly if they've done something to you that's illegal, that they need justice. They need consequences. And there are altogether appropriate times that we would actually remove ourselves from a situation, from a relationship, so as not to perpetuate harm done against us. But the reality is, we just kind of like mercy for us and justice for them. And Jesus calls us to be different, to be distinctive, to be irrational, and to extend mercy, to extend forgiveness to the person who doesn't deserve it. Because in the story Jesus told, the king was willing to absorb the debt that we could never repay. We must be willing to extend the same kind of mercy that he did, the same kind of forgiveness. And notice what Jesus says. This is how my Father will respond to you unless you forgive your brother or your sister from your heart. That sort of ratchets it up a notch, doesn't it? I mean, I can't tell you how many times. I have 3 kids, 17, 14, 10. I can't tell you how many times this scenario has played out in our family. Right? There is the offender and there is the offended. And whatever the scenario is, whatever has just happened, dad then comes into the scene, separates everybody. And what does dad say? What do you need to say, right? What do I say to the offender? What do you need to say? I'm sorry. And then to the offended, and what do you need to say? I forgive you. Right? There's no heart in that. But it plays out time and time and time again. And the fact is that forgiveness is an act of the will. If we wait on feelings to lead us, we oftentimes will never choose to forgive. That sometimes we need to make the choice. We need to make that act of the will and trust that our feelings will follow. And sometimes we have to ask God, would you help us to feel it? There's a powerful story about a woman named Corrie Ten Boom. Corrie was a survivor of the Holocaust. She spent time in a Nazi concentration camp, not because she was Jewish, but because her family harbored some Jews, and they got found out, they got discovered, and she was thrown into Ravensbrück concentration camp. After the war was over, she then went around preaching the good news, the gospel of Jesus, telling people about God's love, God's mercy, God's forgiveness. And on one particular night, after she finished her sermon, and as the crowds departed, she saw a man beginning to walk towards her. And she knew right away who he was. That he apparently hadn't recognized her, but she knew him. Because he was one of the guards at Ravensbrück. And she saw him and she remembered the shame that she felt when she and so many other women had to be paraded naked in front of him. She remembered the horrible hunger pangs, the starvation that they experienced in that camp. She remembered the fleas that infested their dormitories. She remembered that her sister died in that camp. And she had just preached this message about the forgiveness of God, and she used the image that God takes our sin and removes our sin from us and puts it at the bottom of the sea. And now this man, this guard, came to her after the sermon, after the service, and said, it's so good for me to know, to hear that I'm forgiven by God. I was I was a guard at Ravensbrook. And it's so comforting for me to know that, now that I'm a Christian, that my sins are removed from me and they are at the bottom of the sea. But he said, I need to hear it from you. Corey, will you forgive me? And she writes these words. And still I stood there with coldness clutching my heart. But forgiveness is not an emotion. I know that too. Forgiveness is an act of the will. And the will can function regardless of the temperature of the heart. Jesus, help me, I prayed silently. I can lift my hand. I can do that much. You, Jesus, you supply the feeling. And so woodenly, mechanically, I thrust my hand into the one outstretched to me. And as I did so, an incredible thing took place. The current started from my shoulder and it raced down my arm and it sprang into our joined hands. And then this healing warmth seemed to flood my whole being, bringing tears to my eyes. I forgive you, brother, I cried with all of my heart. And for a long moment, we grasped each other's hands, the former guard and the former prisoner. And she concludes and says, I had never known God's love so intensely as I did then. Forgiveness is an act of the will. Sometimes we have to choose to forgive even when we don't feel it, and we have to trust that the feelings will follow, and we have to ask God, would you help me to feel it? Would you help me to engage in this act of will? To be willing to forgive from my heart. Now, these words of Jesus are strong. This apparently is a really big deal to God. And I think we have to reflect on why is it? Why is it such a big deal to God that we would be willing to forgive those who have hurt us? And I think there's a couple of reasons why it's such a big deal. And the first is that unforgiveness is self-sabotage for our souls. Unforgiveness is self-sabotage for our souls. That ultimately the one who is trapped is us. I remember an experience that I had a few years ago. I was away on a writing retreat for a weekend and some friends of ours had let me stay at their home. They were away out of state. And so I was there to do some writing over the course of the weekend. And I went to bed that night completely exhausted and woke up in the middle of the night. And it was just sort of warm in the room. And so I got up, kind of stumbled out of bed. I think I had taken my glasses off and left them on the bedside table. And I stumbled over to the wall to adjust the thermostat just to bump it down a couple of degrees. And I hit the button and a strange noise came out. And it turns out I had approached the wrong keypad and I just armed the alarm and it was the middle of the night and I was suddenly trapped. I didn't know if there were motion sensors throughout the house and if I even walked outside of the door of that room, if I would set off the alarm. These were friends of Kim's and so she had the contact info. I didn't even know how to reach them. I was trapped. I had locked myself in to this little room. As it turns out, the next morning I was rather rudely awakened as a neighbor who had a garage door opener was just dropping some things off in the garage. Had no idea that I had set the alarm. She opens the garage door and the thing just starts blaring, waking up everybody else in the neighborhood. I mean, the cops come out. I'm standing outside in my pajamas trying to explain why I'm in the house to begin with, much less why I set the alarm and now it's going off and I have no idea how to turn it off. I had trapped myself, locked myself in that little room, and I think that's what happens. When we choose not to forgive someone who has hurt us, the one who is ultimately imprisoned is us. I love the way that Frederick Buechner speaks of this when he says, of the seven deadly sins, anger is possibly the most fun. To lick your wounds, to smack your lips over grievances long past, to roll your tongue over the prospect of bitter confrontation still to come. Anybody else identify with that? To savor the last toothsome morsel, both the pain that you are given and the pain that you are giving back. In many ways, it's a feast fit for a king. The chief drawback is that the one that you are wolfing down is yourself. The skeleton at the feast is you. This is a big deal to God because God knows that unforgiveness is self-sabotage for our souls. And the ones who ultimately get trapped and locked inside, us. But I think there's another aspect of this as well. And that is that unforgiveness is a denial that we have truly understood grace. Unforgiveness is a denial that we have truly understood grace. Just as that unforgiving servant didn't understand the grace that he'd been shown by the great king, so too our unwillingness to forgive another demonstrates that we haven't really understood grace. You see, the only way that we really understand grace is when we understand the height of God's holiness and the depth of our depravity, how high he is in his holiness and how deep we are in our sin. And it's then and only then that we truly understand the extent to which God has gone to take our debt from us. That Jesus came into the world to absorb our debt, a debt that we could never pay back to God. And that it's only when we truly come to understand the reality of God's grace in our lives, then we're able to do the irrational, the unthinkable, and express grace to others who've wounded us. And when we're unwilling to do that, it's as though we're saying to God, I deserve to be forgiven. And they don't. When we harbor unforgiveness, it's a denial that we've really come to understand the grace of God. Now, don't get me wrong. Forgiveness is hard. Forgiveness sometimes, for some of us, takes time. For some of us, it takes having people walk with us through a process. For some of us, it may take some professional help to really enable us to engage the act of forgiveness. So I don't want to make it sound simple. It's hard. But if we truly understand the grace of God, then we understand the call of God on our lives to express that grace to other people. And so this morning, as we wrap up our time together, I simply want to offer you a process. It's not a formula, right? It's not three simple steps to forgiveness, because it's just not that simple. But it is a process that I think if God's stirring something in you, if there's a wound that's not been healed, I want to give you this process, because the fact is the relationship may never be healed. Forgiveness is not the same as reconciliation. The relationship may never be healed, but you can be. And this process, as I outlined it on my notes, I came to realize actually forms a bit of an acronym. And that kind of annoyed me, because I don't really like acronyms in my sermons, but maybe it'll be helpful for you to remember. The acronym is A-I-R, AIR. Perhaps you could say, forgiveness is like the air we breathe. But if you do that, it's gonna annoy me, so let's forget I even suggested that, right? A-I-R. The first is acknowledge the hurt. Acknowledge the hurt. Sometimes what happens is we actually can be prone to take things that are not really a big deal and make a big deal of them. And I think the word for us is we need to get over that, right? In Jesus' name. But sometimes what happens is we take things that really are a big deal and we say, oh, it's not a big deal. We're unwilling to actually acknowledge the hurt. And I think there's a couple of reasons why we can be prone to want to not acknowledge the hurt. Fear and pride. We don't want to acknowledge the hurt because I don't want to face that. I don't want to feel those feelings again. But if we don't actually come to and acknowledge and deal with that wound, it will never heal. Sometimes we don't acknowledge hurt because of fear, sometimes because of pride. I'll never let that person hurt me. And we buck up and we blow it off. And yet we still have a wound that's been unaddressed. We have to acknowledge the hurt. Second, we have to identify the debt incurred. Right? Acknowledge the hurt, identify the debt incurred. We can't be hurt specifically and then forgive generally. That in order for us really to process through forgiveness, we need to specifically identify the debt that's been incurred. This is what they did to me. This is what it took from me. This is what they owe me. To identify the debt incurred. And then finally, to relinquish it. To relinquish it, to let it go. To choose, right, an act of the will, to choose to relinquish the debt, to give up both the desire and the right to make them pay. And sometimes we have to engage this step of the process over and over and over again. Because really letting it go is hard. And yet when we come to truly understand the reality that Jesus absorbed our debt, when we truly come to understand that we owed God a debt that we could never repay, but that he has taken pity on us, that he has canceled our debt, and that he has set us free, then and only then can we find the freedom and the ability to do the irrational, to do the unexplainable, to do the questionable act of forgiveness. Will you join me in prayer? And as our heads are bowed and our eyes are closed across this room, I just want to walk you through that process, because this isn't something that you need to wait and do later. It's something you can work through with God right here and right now. And I believe that God wants to work healing in the lives of many people across this room right here, right now. And so I want to invite everybody just to take your right hand and just clench it in a fist. And I want you to acknowledge the hurt. Acknowledge the hurt. To take that hurt before God. That as you hold your hand in a fist, to think about that person and what they did, and just acknowledge before God, God, they hurt me. Then I want you to identify the debt incurred. To name before God, God, this is what they did to me. This is what they took from me. This is what they owe me. To identify before God the debt that they have incurred to you. And I want you to ask God to give you the ability, to give you the strength to relinquish it. Ask God to give you the ability and to let the feelings follow, to just open up your hand. And I invite you, when you're ready, to do just that. Open up your hand. Relinquish the debt. Father, I pray that you would work in each of these lives. God, thank you for the way in which you're prompting men and women across this room, children, students across this room to forgive today, to engage in this process with you. And I pray that you would work in their lives and in their hearts, that you'd help the feelings to follow, Lord, but for them to engage that act of will. And we thank you that the only way that we can ever get there, the only way that we can ever do that, is by embracing the reality that you have done that for us. And so, Lord, we thank you and we praise you in Jesus' name.